Good morning, everyone. My name is Ryan, as Jude said, and I'm going to talk a little bit about our family planning waiver, and that's a Medicaid waiver. We started our program in, we applied in 1998 and have had it implemented since 1999, so we're one of a handful of the longest running family planning waivers in the nation. So to begin, I'll just say I have no relationships to disclose, and I'll go right into the presentation then. So sometimes I'm often asked about why are they called waivers? And so I thought I'd explain that for those who don't understand. Medicaid has very specific regulations about how Medicaid must be operated in a state. And there are some optional things, but there are also some very prescribed things. And with waivers of any kind, a state is usually saying, I want to experiment. I want to not follow this regulation and instead do this. And without spending any more federal money, do something creative, innovative, maybe reach a different population, a larger population. And so to do that, you have to request permission to have that regulation waived. And so that's why those are called waivers. Again, it's to test novel delivery systems, eligibility groups, specified services. So for family planning in particular, it is a finite set of services. It is not the whole gamut of primary health care as covered under Medicaid, but just those that are related to contraceptive management. And it allows us to serve an eligible population that has a higher income than our regular Medicaid would. So right now in the nation, there are 27 states with family planning waivers. Most are income level based, meaning the federal poverty level. But initially, there were a couple that started by only offering this set of expanded services to those women who had just had a Medicaid paid birth. And so that, you know how they have 60 days coverage after the birth of their baby. And this would have been a service or a set of benefits offered to those women after that regular Medicaid terminated, and they would have had this. Our theory in Oregon and many other states as well has been, let's try to get them before they even have that initial pregnancy if they are not interested in being pregnant. So this, I think more and more states are going toward the income level approach and not just the postpartum. I think it's important to have those postpartum women on there, definitely. I just don't think it should be focused solely on that. The thing that's so attractive about family planning Medicaid waivers is a 90% federal match, and that is just such a sexy thing, isn't it? I mean, that is what we're all in it for, is to have this great match relationship with the federal agency, and it helps you really make a good argument in your state if you don't already have a Medicaid waiver. Can I ask just real quickly, anybody who works for a state in here? Okay, great.
New Mexico,
great, okay. That helps me know how to talk differently. So obviously, the focus is on preventing unintended pregnancies, and again, in any waiver you are suggesting that you can do this body of work without it costing the feds any more than it would if you didn't do it. So, for Oregon, just to give you some background about how we began, often I'm asked, how do you get political support to move forward asking for a waiver? And so what I'll say is we did the initial research on waivers, and at the time I think there were only two other states that had just begun with their waivers. And so we had discussions with our Medicaid agency to just ferret out. I'm in the public health division, not the Medicaid agency. And if any of you are ever interested in starting a waiver in your state, I would recommend that you, for a family planning waiver, you do that. Pair your Title 10 and your Medicaid family planning waiver together. We're the only state in the nation that has done that, and I can tell you the benefits are so many. I can tell you so many horror stories of what other family planning waivers that have experienced by having it run by just the Medicaid agency. I think there's a level of expertise held by folks running the Title 10 programs, and I think that there's an expertise in family planning as well as just a relationship with the providers already providing those services. So it makes a lot of sense. So we initially wanted to have a policy package that we went through our legislature for approval, and the timing wasn't right. We couldn't get any legs to it. Nobody was interested. But a few months after we had tried that, we became aware of interest in teen pregnancy prevention. We had a governor at the time who was very focused on teen pregnancy prevention, and our Ways and Means Committees was very interested in that. So we repackaged this waiver approach to really focus a little bit more on teens so that in our presentation to our legislature, it caught their attention. And it wasn't just focused on teens, certainly, but could, you know, not only can we help with teen pregnancy prevention, we can help with overall pregnancy prevention. So I would encourage any of you to just be willing to be creative on how to switch your pitch at any time. So again, our governor at the time had was a strong supporter of teen pregnancy prevention, and then the incoming governor authored the Oregon Health Plan. John Kitzhaber, you may have heard of his name, MD, very into healthcare in general, very public health minded, and so big supporter as well. And one of the key things I would suggest to any of you is to work closely with your provider community and key stakeholders. We worked with our county health departments, federally qualified health centers, and our Planned Parenthood affiliates. We have two in Oregon. We wanted their input as we shaped the waiver, how we would operationalize all of it, and even getting their input on things to include in the application itself. So I can tell you that that is one of the key successes, is to work closely with your provider group. And then the way we found the money, and that's another question I often get, is how'd you come up with that initial money to be the match? Even if it's only 10%, that can be a lot of money. So at the time, we had Title X and we had state general funds. Those went out to the county health departments. And so we worked with our county health departments and said, hey, we have an idea. How about if we don't give you that state match anymore? You can imagine how excited they were to hear that. And instead, we use that state match to leverage it for this waiver. It'll be our 10%. We'll be able to bring in more money that will support the family planning services in Oregon. But it was initially kind of a tough sell. I mean, you're taking something from them. This is brand new. It doesn't have the, you know, 11, 12 years of experience it has now where people know it works. So it was initially a hard sell, but we were able to do it. And I can say that there were a few counties who were on board immediately, and some of the larger ones that had a significant amount of state general fund were less supportive until they started to hear how much money those smaller counties were starting to bring in, and then they were all over it. So if any of you ever want help on making those arguments, we can help you there. So again, back to the provider partnership, it's just the key of really making this work effectively in any state. And we established an advisory work group. FPEP stands for Family Planning Expansion Project. Not a very good name, I realize, but that's the name of our program. So we made sure that the representatives on this advisory group were made up from a sampling of all of our types of providers. We don't do anything without discussing it with this provider group. We make sure that they're aware of what we'd like to pursue. We want to get their input on it. We want to find out operationally how that would work in a clinic. We share with them what we're hearing from our project officers at CMS, and share with CMS some of the anecdotal information from the clinic setting. And I think that just keeps everyone well informed, and buy-in from your provider community is just critical. It builds rapport, trust, collaboration, and today we still meet monthly. I should say we're scheduled to meet monthly, but we cancel if there aren't any issues. And after doing it 11 years, we kind of have it down. So we might meet every, maybe 3 or 4 times a year now, but we do keep the schedule monthly just in case there's a development or some new issue. And right now we are waiting to hear about our approval for another renewal. So again, back to how waivers work, you request permission to waive a regulation, you get an initial 5-year period of approval, and that's called a demonstration project. And then you can renew that, but they're for only 3-year chunks. So we have had 1 5-year and 2 3-year renewals, and we're in the midst of gaining our 3rd 3-year renewal. So for FPEP, I told you it started in 1999. It had been authorized through October 31st of 2009, but we were issued an extension through January. Things are going well, conversations are good, so I just think it's a bit of a backlog with the change in administration and new leadership put in place at CMS. We're the only state in the nation that administers Title X and family planning side by each. We serve women, men, and teens under our waiver, and we go to 185% of the federal poverty level currently. We served about 69,000 clients through about 154 local clinics. That's 2008 data. It has increased, I'm happy to say. And we have over 100 clinics that are just FPEP. That are both FPEP and Title X, and the remainder are just FPEP. Does that make sense? So our county health departments, okay. In the Title X clinics, we really appreciate that model because if someone doesn't qualify for the waiver or regular Medicaid, there still is a way they can access those services on a sliding fee scale. FPEP eligibility, we're one of three states in the nation who have point of service eligibility assistance. So a client would come into a clinic, they say they need birth control, there is the front page of a one-page form that they complete, and the clinic staff will put that into a statewide database that we have. It's a web-based system. They put that information in there, and they do collect documentation for citizenship verification if the client happens to have it with them, which is hardly ever, because who of us walk around with our birth certificate or our passport? So they do that, and if all the eligibility criteria is met, then they get immediate determination and can serve the client right then and there. Before we started the program, we did extensive work with our existing family planning clinics in Oregon, and we talked to women who access services there, and we did a report that's on our website that you're welcome to access. It's called What Women Are Saying. And it helped inform us how to run the waiver. And the key piece was they don't want to have to apply to something and wait 2 or 4 or 6 weeks to find out they were eligible or not. I always say you can get plenty pregnant in 6 weeks. So it's in everyone's best interest if you hand them birth control the minute they say, I want birth control. And they didn't want to have to be given a prescription to go to a pharmacy, that they might have transportation issues, that they might not have time to make that extra stop. And so we thought anything that prevented them immediately starting on birth control was probably not in their best interest or the point of the waiver. So we made sure that they could have same-day clinics access and also leave with birth control in hand from the clinic, no extra stop. You have to be living in Oregon, you have to have the income level met, you have to be a U.S. citizenship, and that has to be verified. You can also be a lawful permanent resident. As of our 2006 renewal, which is our current state of approval, you must be uninsured. Prior to that, for the first 8 years of the waiver, it could be a secondary insurance or health coverage, let's put it that way. And I still believe strongly that it should be allowed to be secondary, as is regular Medicaid, and that's one of our requests in our current waiver application, is to remove that. What we see happening is that people who might have some health insurance, maybe they have a premium, copay, deductibles, and they say, ooh, if I didn't have that, I could get this for free, so I'll dump that so I can get this for free. That doesn't help any of us. If we are a secondary coverage, I do think it saves both the state and the feds money in the long run. So I would like us to get back to being a secondary option. And then Social Security numbers. In our first 8 years of the waiver, we encouraged SSNs from teens, but we didn't require it if they didn't know how to get a hold of it. They didn't want to ask their mom or dad for it, because mom or dad would say, why do you need it? And they didn't want to say they were accessing family planning services. 80% of our teens in those 8 years did offer an SSN, but for that 20% that didn't know it and didn't want to ask, we were happy to still get them on birth control. In the 2006 renewal, we were required to stop doing that. We have seen a 47% drop in our teen population under FPEP because of that. So that's one of our asks again in this, is please may we go back to where we were, because it's, again, in everyone's best interest that our teens aren't pregnant. We don't issue any ID cards at all on the program. We have that statewide web-based database, and any clinic, when a person walks in, can look up to see if that person's already eligible and current. And so that's how it transfers from clinic to clinic. So citizenship verification, you all know about the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, maybe some of you do. It was implemented in 2006, and that was a big hardship on a family planning clinic. Because again, we have that point of service eligibility. There isn't a determination process behind the scenes that where you can dig around and look for paperwork. We want them to have birth control in hand walking out the door, right? So we still wanted that. We worked with our providers, and then we worked with our department's leadership. And what we did is we got state general fund to support the strategy that we called a one-time exception. So client walks in, they don't have their birth certificate, they don't have passport, they want birth control. We don't want to say, come back when you have your birth certificate, then we'll see you. We don't want to say that because you can get plenty pregnant while they go look for that, right? So we said, why don't we use our funds? We'll make sure that we don't stick the provider, like a Title 10 provider would still have to see that client, and we didn't want all these FPEP eligibles just crashing over to the Title 10 side, and Title 10's inadequately funded. There's an understatement. So any of you know Title 10 will know that. So we decided, let's put some state general fund forward. Let's make sure those women get served. It's largely women. And they walk away with birth control, and then we can find some time, give them the time to bring their citizenship documentation back to us. And then future visits could be covered at 90-10 match. So that was our logic in doing that. And even with this one-time exception, we still saw a 33% decline in visits. And we think what happened, and I have some data to show you in a moment, is word of mouth. You know, somebody goes in and they're told by a front desk person, you need to be a citizen to get on this, and they're told things about documentation. They don't really understand that. They know, I want birth control. That's what's on their mind. They don't get the paperwork in. They leave and they tell five of their friends, oh, you can't get it there anymore. And that's not correct, but that's how it plays out in the community, so people stop coming in. And again, that teen drop of 47%, we think that was a large piece of just that SSN. If you don't have your SSN, they won't see you. And that just killed it. So what we saw is a real impact to our Title 10 clinics. They, because of that shift, they still have to serve those people whether they qualify for FPEP or not. That meant their money had to stretch further, which meant they had to do staff layoffs, close clinics, or reduce their hours. Maybe they had a five-day-a-week clinic that's now a three-day-a-week clinic. So it really hurt access. So we did a few more things. We said, well, let's see if we can work with our vital records office. Let's do an electronic match, and we do that twice a month. So in this web-based data system that we have, our clinics will collect, if the client says, I was born here in Oregon, they would fill out just some base information. They'd put that into the system. And twice a month, we pull it out of the system, match it with our vital records, and then repopulate the database to say, you know, here's how many we found were eligible. It's very simple, it's very efficient, it's very effective, and it works great. Doesn't work if you were born in another state, though, because there isn't a statewide relationship. And because a lot of the information is very private and should be safeguarded, it's just very difficult for other states to want to share data. We'd be happy, well, I'd say our program would be happy to share it, but I don't think our vital records is that happy to share it. So there's some issue there that I think we need to work on. But we thought, well, we don't want to let that make this still such a hard program to get on. So what we did instead is we took state general fund again, and again, working with our provider community who could really advocate for this with our leaders. And what we do is we purchase the birth certificate for that client. So we have on our website a link to every state in the nation. And so if a person comes in and tells the clinic I was born in Arkansas, they click on Arkansas, they print that state's birth certificate request form. They help the client fill it out. Many states require a notary. California does, and we're a border state to California. We get a lot of traffic from California. So we encourage them to go ahead and have one of their staff become a notary. It costs about $75 a year. Certainly the return on investment is there for them, and most of our clinics do have a notary on staff because we get so many California birth certificates. So they notarize it, they send that to us, we provide prepaid, postage paid envelopes to all of our clinics, and they bundle them up once a week and send them to us. And then we have a staff person who keeps track of it in a database, gets a check cut so we can put that with the requests that go to that state, off it goes. And we're finding turnaround time is about 2 weeks. It's not too bad. It's about 20 days is about the average. So again, we believe it's, you know, it's about $15 is the average cost. We believe the investment is worth it with state general funds. Our clinics absolutely appreciate that the state is willing to help them have future visits covered under FPEP. So it's a win-win. It's a really hugely effective process. So our database, I've already told you about, is web-based, and the clients offer the information on a form, and the clinic staff put it in. And they can also check to see if the person is still pending. Like, if they use that one-time exception, then if they're still pending citizenship, they will know that, and they'll know it wouldn't be a service that they could bill to FPEP until that was verified. So right now, where we're at, the last year we've been really focusing on a lot of social marketing, and we've been doing that because of our huge decrease since we implemented the DRA requirements. And we just think it's not that people don't need the services, it's there's a word of mouth issue. We have a tainted program because they think the wrong thing about the program. So we have spent quite a lot of time updating all of our outreach materials. We had a transit ad running that ran in every bus system in all of Oregon, and that's the 5 major cities of Oregon. The rural areas don't have buses, but we did billboards in those areas. We also have electric rail in Portland, and we had buses and the electric rail wrapped. They're called wraps, so the external. And then we had Michelangelo's, which are not quite on the ceiling, but all, you know, on that part of the ceiling. So those ran, they started running in late December and early January of the year. And then I'm really excited to say, and over the summer, we started a theater ad campaign. So you know when you go to see a movie and they have those, you know, please silence your cell phone, and did you know about this dentist in the area, and, you know, all these things. We were able to do that. Now, we tried to do that when we first launched FPEP, and Regal Cinemas, I don't know if they're out here, are they out in the east? They're the biggest in Oregon as far as cinemas are concerned, biggest owner, and they refused. They weren't supporters of family planning, so they refused. But now they said yes. They wouldn't say birth control, because we were trying to make the ad about birth control. They wouldn't say that, but they'll say family planning, which kind of cracks me up, because that's kind of broader than birth control. So I think, whatever, we'll just go with it. They said yes. So they actually did agree to do that, and that's in every single theater, on every single screen, for every single movie. So that's huge, right? So then paranoia sets in, and I think, okay, mothers going to Disney movies with their 5-year-old are going to be mad. You know, that's immediately what I think. They're not going to want their kids saying, Mom, what's family planning? So we were a little worried that as soon as anyone complained to the theater, Regal would say, we're yanking it. So we employed the help of our Planned Parenthood's advocacy volunteer group. There's over 60,000 people. And so they sent a message out saying, as you go to movies this summer, please compliment the manager on how proactive they're being by having these ads about family planning. So we thought if they got a couple negatives, but they got a more positives, maybe they'd weigh it out, and nobody's yanked it. We can't believe it. We thought our phones would ring off the hook. So we had one complaint, and it was from a billboard in a rural area, but that's been it. So that was pretty good. So what we're doing now is trying to get hip, and that's tough for a bureaucracy, you know. We've been running this program, like I say, for 11 years, and we are very aware that this our target population is 19 to 28-year-olds. That's the 3/4 of the age group that we serve fall in that age group, or 3/4 of the people we see fall in that age group. So 19 to 28-year-olds. And so we've been doing some formative research and focus groups and finding out where are you, because that's where we want to go. Nobody wants to pick up a phone anymore. They all do MySpace, Facebook, Twitter. We did an interesting thing over the last few months where we had all of those billboards and bus kiosks and bus systems I've telling you about. We put both a phone number and a web page. Phone number hardly had any change, I mean minimal. The webs, thousands and thousands and thousands. So I was like, oh, well, I believe it, because nobody's picking up the phone to call. I'd pick up a phone. I'm not the target population. So I've been learning a lot about MySpace and Facebook. I used to call it MyFace every time I talked about it, so I'm very proud that I'm actually calling it the right thing. And we're going to do some games and some badges, which I don't know if you all know what those are. I had to learn. Thank you for being in my age group. it's a thing you can click on and you can send to a friend. And so they can see something about FPEP and go, hey, this is cool, and off they send it. Yeah, they share it, and it kind of expands. Same with e-cards, same with, there are widgets and other, do you know these things better than I do? You're probably shaking your head, she's got it all wrong and backwards. Am I right? Oh, yay. Okay, so I've been studying. Okay, so we want them to tell a friend, right? We want them to just, that's the fastest way it's going to spread, is if the gal who came in and got FPEP services tells five of her friends, and so on and so on and so on, right? So we're working on getting approvals for that, which is not easy in a bureaucracy, because this seems newfangled to old fuddy-duddies. But it is proven, and it is evidence-based. So we're thinking, you know, we'll at least be able to dabble a little bit. We think it's cutting edge, even though we're about 15 years behind, like the private sector. But for government, it is cutting edge. So we're also considering rebranding our program. FPEP just is a dud of a name. It is not attractive at all. And when you are talking to legislators and you call the Family Planning Expansion Project, they think that, exactly, the laughter says it all. They think the most negative connotation of expansion is you're going to need millions and millions of more dollars because you're going to get all these hordes of people in, which is the point, after all, to prevent unintended pregnancy. But we meant it to expand availability of family planning services, but that doesn't play well when you're working with legislators who are concerned about money and growing programs too big. So we're looking at that, seeing if we can get some leverage for that. And then we have two ethnic groups that we, no matter what we've done, we just don't seem to be able to get the numbers where they should be. One is African American and the other is Asian and Pacific Islanders. So we're going to be doing some special focus groups with those populations to see what it is that we're doing or not doing that's working or not working. But interestingly enough, the social networking pieces, all the social media, plays the same across ethnic groups. In fact, Latinas and African Americans use it more than whites. So we're finding that to be really interesting and helpful. So let me give you a couple. By the way, Ellen had put on a chair in the back, in the front, a handout if you want any of this. And I want to tell you about a couple of errors that I found last night in the hotel room. So on page 14 and 15, they're exactly the same, except for two things that I'll tell you about, and really it's still exactly the same. So on the second page, on page 15, it says excluding one-time exception visits. Both pages exclude one-time visits, so I'm not sure what happened, but something bad happened. Let's see, how do I do this? Shift back, no. Shift tab, no. Okay, we'll just go with this one. And the other thing that's different is on your page 14, that one goes through June of 2008, and page 15 that's up on the screen goes through April of 2008. Pardon me? It was a right click. Oh, thank you. See what I mean? Oh, no. There it goes. Oh, I think I can't tell my right from my left. I'm really technologically challenged if I can't do that. There, you were right. Okay, so page 14, you can see, let's stick with this one because it has the most information in it. So you can see when we implemented the Deficit Reduction Act with this line, and FPEP is this lavender square, and you can see the tanking begin. You can see how nice it was doing, and then boom, just down it goes. And you can also see that we've had some blips, because when we look at when we started to do our campaign for outreach things, it started to come back up. And if you continue on, you can see on this page how this one goes through June, and so starting on the upward trend again. So what we're doing, I think, is paying off. We also did some response surveys in the clinics, asking clients, how did you hear about us, or did you see the ads? 37% of the respondents said they had. So I don't know if that's what prompted them to come in. They may have already going to be coming in anyway, but we just want to know, are they seeing the ads? And that seems to be helping with the upward trend. I'll tell you, summertime's our slowest time every single year, I think because school is out. I think they load up in May, get through the summer, and load up in September. So we see that, and so we're just now coming out of our slump for the summer there. For the one-time visits, I'll tell you, that first month that we offered it, well, there was about 2,500 of those visits used, and then it's tailored down since then, and the average is about 1,300-1,400 a month that use that one-time only visit. So clearly, people don't walk around with documentation on them, and we're able to resolve almost all of them through our systems that we have in place. Okay, how am I doing on time? 2 minutes. Okay, let's see how fast I can be. Oh, I can do this. Okay, so, okay, good. Change in FPEP visits by age. You can see what I'm talking about. The teen population, this is under 18, and this group is 18 to 19. You can see that clearly is the biggest population that had trouble. And again, because we can verify the citizenship for the folks, it's really related to SSN. A lot of the teens just don't have it. And we tried working with, we have some school-based health clinics in Multnomah County, which is where Portland is situated. It's a public school system that allows the dispensing of birth control on the school-based health clinic, which is great. We have a couple other counties that allow that. Isn't that fantastic? I know. I love it. Oregon's so progressive. So we thought, well, if the kid can go to the office and say, I need to get my Social Security number from you, they're asking for their own information, and the office should release it, then that student could take it back to the school-based health clinic and get enrolled. And that just didn't work. The offices weren't willing to release it. We tried having school-based clinic work with the administration of the school. They didn't want to release it for privacy reasons. That makes sense. Kids didn't want to be bothered. They already are out of class to go to the school-based health clinic. They don't want to have this extra hurdle of having to go to the office and wait in line there. So it wasn't very effective. And that's, again, why we're trying with CMS to get approval to go back to where we encourage it and waive it when a student is worried about confidentiality. Also, we think that the Deficit Reduction Act was put into place, the citizenship requirements were put into place because some thought that immigrants, people who weren't citizens of the nation, were accessing services that they shouldn't be. And so we did a little look 18 months prior to the DRA, 18 months post, and looked at, in our Hispanic population, and for us, where we're situated, it's mostly immigrants from Mexico that we have as non-citizens. And what we see is that it's just statistically not significant at all. So we think what the DRA, the citizenship verification pieces, are there to try and prove just the case isn't made there. So going forward, we submitted our renewal last May, and now we're extended through January. We're asking to increase our federal poverty level to 250%. We're asking to waive the SSNs, as I've said. We're asking to lift some of the eligibility restrictions added at renewal. One is no insurance. We'd like that lifted. We've also asked to have the citizenship verification requirements lifted. I have no hope that that will happen, so. But you got to ask. You got to make the case, but I'm pretty sure that's not going to happen. I don't think CMS has the authority, actually. I think it's a congressional requirement, so I think CMS could agree all they wanted, and they still couldn't lift it. And we're asking to have STI treatment covered at regular match, not 90-10, because you can't say that that's contraceptively related. And the same is true for repeat PAPs and colposcopies. From a client's perspective, which is how we try to do everything, we try to have client-centered care, and they're coming in to get reproductive health care. They think this is like going to a gynecologist. And so it's not for them just about birth control. It's also about their pap smears, about STIs. So we think it makes sense from a care point of view to offer those wraparound services that should be there. And we're also looking at trying to get to cost-based reimbursement. We're going to have to make some big choices with what we get approved for and what we have money to do, and then see which, by prioritizing where we land. But I would really like to get to cost-based reimbursement for our providers, if possible. We already pay the supplies at cost. I'd like to get the services at that, too, at some point. And there it is. I finished. Thank you.
We've got a very nice small group in here.
It's intimate.
Only two presenters, so we can be very casual. But if you have some questions for you, want to come?
They're either bored or we were excellent.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
It's just something I may have heard it wrong, but you said about 80% of the teens were providing their social security number. But you had a 47% drop off if they were already providing it.
We get new teens all the time, you know? But it's the word of mouth thing. We think they're not even coming in. We think that they heard from one student, one friend, you can't get it anymore. And then they tell their friends and then nobody even comes in. Because then when we discovered, when we thought, okay, we're on to something here, what are we gonna do to just, you know, make sure people know the program's still available? We did a lot of outreach that said, don't have your birth certificate? No worries. Don't have your SSN? Don't worry. We can help you with that. And we did, you know, all kinds of just special marketing on that to try to correct that misunderstanding.
Did you focus group that to get that understanding that that really
was the
issue?
We focus grouped through our clinics. So we did. We used people who were already going to our clinics, which would only tell you about people who actually showed up. But we didn't go to the ones who never went. Like if they had heard from a friend, we don't know about that.
Is your Medicaid division in your health department or
no.
Is it a separate department?
Well, it sort of is, but not really. So we have
a health cabinet type of thing?
We have the Department of Health, Department of Human Services, and so it has mental health and addictions, it has public health, it has the Medicaid agency,
okay,
has
so
self-sufficiency
you're under the same
umbrella.
Because I have a question about so that is what enables you to get the linkage.
We partnered with our Medicaid agency. So when we do our application, it has both of our names on it.
Okay,
we
now,
run it, yes. We do all the work of it, but we keep them in the loop. There's no kind of a no surprise approach, and their name is also on the application. So it's not just us.
So then I have a follow up question for John, because in most states, that is not the case.
Right.
In most states, the Medicaid agency is not alive at all with the public health.
Right.
Which is why you have transformation grants.
No, but it's well and good to have the transformation grants. But if you're looking at, for example, medical home initiatives and disease management initiatives, the disease management, like for asthma for children or for diabetes or those kinds of things, those are in the public health department,
right,
or maybe in a community health and family services department, not related administratively to the state Medicaid agency, which is an entirely different culture from the health department.
It's true.
And so Medicaid,
I used to work there, I know,
portrayed itself as a public health program. Only in recent years does the word public health appear in the same sentence as Medicaid.
That's right, that's true.
Okay, so the transformation grants are a wonderful opportunity, but there's very little likelihood of the kind of linkage that is really required, particularly for, say, patient-centered medical home initiatives, which really require community-based services that are in not only public health, but also in local public health agencies at the front lines.
Mm-hmm.
So what kinds of things are going to be in this Medicaid grant which will make it possible for a state to really utilize it in the manner that you're speaking without that kind of public health linkage that
Well, and I think we have our problems, certainly,
where the
Medicaid agency, I can't say that we're really, like, linked with Medicaid. I think some relationships were forged for this endeavor, and that has worked. But I think when I look at MCH and some, you know, maternal health, maternal child health, I think there's a lot that could be improved with that. So I think that those collaborations, those connections, I'm loving that you had for a period of time those grants, and I was really devastated to hear you're no longer doing that, because I was thinking we would be all over that.
Yeah.
We need that.
Well, actually, you're right on the money with that. When Mark McClellan was at Dr. McClellan, administrator, he brought in the notion of public health and managing
yes, he did. Together.
And then we began to get more sort of public health oriented, i.e., speaking with ASTO and trying to forge that relationship. But being aware that the two should go hand in hand, but it's state's autonomy. Now they decide to build yeah. those systems. But the bottom line is, if you really want comprehensive care, you gotta connect those dots. And then also, you're right, it is a culture change, and that's what I mentioned a little bit earlier. Things about to radically change the way we deliver care. If the medical home is the sort of tool to move that forward, it is imperative that models like Oregon or other states that can have the growth to lead those, they're gonna have to. I mean, you're not gonna be successful if you don't do it. So we're a long way from that. I think it's still 3 or 4 years, maybe five. That's the trajectory we're on right now. It's not an easy answer.
Right? No.
Yeah. It's all about relationships.
But we're aware of
that. For discussion purposes.
5 years yeah. ago or 4 years ago.
No, you're right.
You may not even have had this conversation.
No,
over here. Yeah. But now we're out talking.
Communication, relationships, that's just it for everything, isn't right. it? It's where I come full circle no matter what project I'm working on. Mm-hmm. If you're not communicating and forging good relations, things don't float.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. One of the other things that we've seen is that there are a lot of memorandums of understanding out there floating between different departments. But it's key to have one good leadership, but two strong memorandums of understanding that really have some meaning to them. A lot of times it's paper, but functionally they really don't yield good results in time. So it's very important.
Yeah.
With the transformation grants, did the states that were involved in those, you called them that it was a collaborative and it was quality improvement, was their methodology or did they do their own thing the way they, whatever they normally do, based on their proposals and how they would accomplish what they were, what their goals were?
Their proposals were pretty much autonomous. I mean, focus on the subject that you want, but there are a couple of principles that you had to follow. One, you had to show us some lessons learned, show us during cost savings, and a few other things that went along with that. But we didn't say to a state, this is what you have to focus on. There was really an opportunity for a state to say, cost of care is a big issue for me. After I look at information technology, looking at tracking those children that are transit, so to speak. We said, fine, that sounds good, but does it have any replicability to other states as well, too? Can we use those lessons learned and apply it in other states? So it was pretty much random. It wasn't a set formula.
So they didn't have measures, and they weren't measuring change along the way, like this next set of grants?
Not normally like that, but we did want to see some type of improved health outcome or some outcome that can be replicated. So no, you're right, it wasn't to the degree that we're going to do now, but states have the autonomy pretty much to do what they want to focus on.
This is another question for both of you regarding the data, okay? Much data collection from Medicaid and NMIS is really claims data, prescriptions in particular, and stuff like that. And AHRQ has a big database based on claims, and you are also collecting data on both claims and visits, or?
Mm-hmm. We actually use, because we pair it with Title 10, they're administered together, we aren't using MMIS for any of the waiver data.
Okay.
We instead, the region 10, which is where Oregon is situated, contracts with a vendor for data collection for Title 10. I don't know if any of you have ever seen the requirements for data on that. It's extensive. It gets down into service level data. It's not as simple as like a procedure code or diagnosis code like we use in claiming. It's very detailed information, even what did you discuss kind of things.
Okay.
So we use that, and then we tacked on some a few boxes that help with the billing side of it. So we get much more data on these visits than we would get through a traditional MMIS.
Okay, because that was my follow-up. So that was my question. In terms of the kinds of measures that we're seeing in other measurement things, even PQRI, which is on the Medicare side, they're looking at actual clinical values like A1C or results or BMIs or, you know, those kinds of things that are not typically in a claims record.
Right.
And then the way the claims are done in different states, the level of granularity, accuracy, and usefulness is very varied.
Right.
So when you're talking about an EHR, are you looking at trying to capture, in addition to the claims information, which does have costs and so forth, any of the clinical values that would be coming off of an electronic medical record?
That's a good question.
Good one.
She gets points for that one.
This is
my field of expertise.
This is good.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I mentioned, I'm a National Library of Medicine fellow in health informatics. So,
oh, you are?
The Title 10 gathers, which I think is really helpful for us on the waiver side, it notes what method the client was on when they came to the clinic, and then the method that they left the clinic being on. And one of the performance requirements we have with our providers is you must continue to work with clients who are on a less effective method and get them on one of the higher effective methods. And so that helps us with their performance and coaching them on, you are not doing the IED counseling you ought to be doing.
That's
right. And then we'd like to get to like a pay for performance at some point.
Absolutely.
Because that's
that would be
that's it, right? Yeah. If you do a good job here, you get more money, right?
That's one of the issues though, because one, you've got to have reliable and valid data, whether you're gonna publicly report it. And for me, you know,
and it has to be comparable too.
That's
you can't have one state collecting the other state collecting oranges.
And that's the goal of it, but we've got to take it a step at a time, because when practices of, as I've seen, they start with a paper. Forms want to maximize my money, but yet have you improve quality first.
Right.
Focus on that.
Right.
Then you can really leverage and sort
right.
of make the name and that pay for performance. That's what you choose to do. Just get back. You just take your data.
I don't know. I'm just all over the place, but I agree with everything that's been said. But my focus is you know, about, you know, going back to your chart, the mm-hmm. chart that you had. And, you know, one of the things that you have mentioned is that wouldn't, on a voluntary basis, you know, organizations would have a chance to apply for, you know, be a part of,
states
would have a chance to be a part of this. But the question is, why doesn't the government, or why don't you think about what's already being used
right.
With most states and incorporating that into your organization? If most
yeah.
states are recognizing HEDIS as the standard for quality, because they have to do chart reviews and so forth and so on, why aren't you guys incorporating that in as part of the standard?
That's a good question. And let me tell you how we got to identifying a public core set of measures. So ARC has this national advisory committee that exists already. So we're able to quickly tap into that and then create a subcommittee of state Medicaid directors. Plenty of state folk, actually, measure developers, NCQA's on that panel as well, many others, but really child health, measure developers, just a whole litany of folk, about 25 of us actually. So that was the first thing. We said, listen, let's look at what states are already doing. If HEDIS is the standard, then why not go with that? But there's another argument to that as well. Let's look at what states have done previously. We've seen HEDIS Lite, some other iteration of that. And states have some rational reasons to say, you know, HEDIS does not work in my state. That measure may not work for my population. So part of that sort of 5-year window is now to say, okay, let's one, look at what states are doing, but let's push them a little bit further, but also two, let's develop measures that are applicable to the Medicaid population. Let's develop those, because a lot of you, if you think about it, work with, I was part of the PQRI program. Actually,
let's not talk about that.
Yeah, it's a totally different program,
yeah.
But Medicaid historically hasn't been at that table. So mm-hmm. it's, what states do,
they were better not there.
That's right. So now we're saying, show us what you do, show us the innovativeness, and let's use it, and let's look at those practices, and let's replicate it. But that's what we really try to do. States have been at the table on that. In fact, NASMED is meeting this week. I'll be there tomorrow. Talk about exactly what I just showed you up here. And the fundamental question is what you just asked before, what's the incentive to do this? So we're saying, we're not gonna actually do something totally different, there is an incentive. It's not a lot at this point, there's a bigger payout down the road once we align all this across the states. We take the S out of CHIP, out of S CHIP, that's CHIP. And we hope to say across that whole program, you're gonna collect this, and you're gonna collect it, it's gonna be aligned. It's a major culture change. That's what
it
is.
Right.
Do you know how hard it was to get people to start saying S chip? And now you're undoing it?
Take
I don't mind that part, but can I move my health center to your state, please?
Right.
Anything else?
We were talking a little bit about your social media campaign.
I saw you shaking your head no, so I thought I was getting it all wrong.
No. How did you get that started, and how much did it cost?
We were really fortunate. I know that this isn't the norm. We started that. Okay, so when we went to the legislature, we meet on a biennial basis. Our budgets are for 2-year periods. So in our 2007-09 budget, we were given additional money. Our Planned Parenthoods are very successful advocates, and we work really closely with them and say, oh, here are our problems, and then they go out and fix them legislatively. So they were able to get $4.5 million extra GF dollars put into, I know that's not the norm, I know it's just astonishing to believe. It took me almost a year to really realize I had a $9 million state budget for family planning waiver alone. And part of that was to get the numbers back up. They saw the decline in what we lost in clients, and especially teens, and so it was to work on outreach. And so how we chose to do that was by doing a social marketing campaign. We wanted to make sure that what we did wasn't just about advertising, but it was about affecting behavior change. So that's why we chose social marketing. We hired a firm to do formative research, and at the same time that was going on, we changed all of our materials, updated them, got them out bigger, did the transit ads, theater ads, the billboards, tried to do like the bare minimum on the marketing side while we were trying to gain information. So then after doing focus groups, working with provider clinics, working with community stakeholders, and gaining the knowledge of what would work, that's what came out of that was you need to do the social networking. If you want to access this population, you need to be able to have them text it to each other. You need to be able to have them send a friend a game that's really fun and silly, but gets them thinking about birth control. So that's now we're in phase two, where we'll be developing those things. And also the name recognition just tanked, so we need to do something that's a little more appealing.
Do you have a contest to rename your program?
In social marketing? Nice. In networking or marketing?
In social networking.
Okay.
Social networking.
Yay, good, because if you do that, it makes my policy folks less scared.
Sure.
Yeah. Because right now they're like, you want to spend what on what on these toys? And like, but they work. It's not just a game. It's a game that gains behavior change.
Ryan, did you have a contest to rename your program?
Well, that's the phase we're in now, is to begin that phase of what should the name be and how do we want to go about designing that. And we just, right before I left, we had signed a contract for the second phase. So I have nothing to report on that yet, because we're just beginning.
Yeah.
But it's kind of fun. I'm learning all kinds of new lingo that I've never had in my arsenal before. And I don't know if you're aware of, there's a group in California. I think they're based in Oakland. Might be San Francisco, but I thought their address was Oakland. ISIS, I-S-I-S. And I think APHA would be wise to contact them to do a presentation at some point. They are the only place we're aware of that focuses on sexuality and technology. And so everything they do is about those two things combined. And one of the pieces of work they've done is there's a text address called 365 24/7. And if you have a question about an STI, you text it to this and you get an answer back saying, here's what the problem is, here's a clinic you can go to, that kind of stuff. And we have worked with them, and we're thinking in the future we'll be able to have something similar for where's a birth control clinic that I can go to, you know. So they can put in their zip code and they'll get back, oh, down the block from you is, you know, this clinic. So we're hoping that we can link some of the social networking things we're doing in with that as well, so that it's not just STI focused but also birth control focused. Yeah. Exciting. And they have a sex tech conference every February in San Francisco. Not a bad place to go. San Francisco.
Only in San Francisco.
Yeah. February will be cold though. No, I think they do nationwide work. They're just based in California. So, but the sex tech conference, I sent two of my staff to last year, and they said it was just amazing. They just came back so much more well-informed about the technology side of things.
Well,
so
now
I'm thinking, I'll go. I want to go in February.
Well, I don't know if Steve Mess was sending me to do so.